Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to see so many friends and colleagues here, including my new colleagues at Sussex, including people I've worked with like T.T. Arvind and Martin Lodge and my PhD supervisor, Christopher Hood. It's really a real pleasure. I'm not going to dwell on the thank yous, though. We're going to get right down to business because I've got quite a lot to get through. And we're going to cover the ages here. We're going to start in 1956 with Willie Robson, Professor of Public Administration at the London School of Economics, who makes this rather controversial claim. Judicial control over public administration was never very effective in this country, despite the smug complacency of lawyers and politicians brought up on Dicey's Law of the Constitution. And, well, maybe you will question whether that was true in 1956, but it's at least changed now, hasn't it? Well, here's a characteristically modest statement by Lord Diplock. It's quite well known. Progress towards a comprehensive system of administrative law has been the greatest achievement of the English court in my judicial lifetime. And Lord Wolfe, another well-known administrative law judge, concludes that on the whole, academic writers have been reasonably kind about what has been achieved. Well, I propose to end that now. Let's consider this person, Caitlin Riley. I consider her to be an admirable young woman, as you will see, but as you will also see, that turns out to be a rather controversial assessment. She was a geology graduate. She wanted to work as a museum guide or curator, but she struggled to get employment in that field. So as a recipient of Job Seeker's Allowance, she got a paid government placement in a museum, and she enjoyed that. But the placement was only for several weeks, and after it came to an end, she continued to work in the museum voluntarily, which went well until she was asked by the Job Centre advisor to enrol in a work fair, work for your benefits scheme for 6 weeks. The result of taking part in this scheme is that she would be unable to continue to work in the museum. And she brought a legal challenge to the decision of the Job Centre advisor, and she won. So that's good news. Here's what she said about her experience. She quit after 2 weeks. Here's what she said. "Those 2 weeks were a complete waste of my time. I was not given any training and I was left with no time to do my voluntary work or search for other jobs." That, as she saw it, was the problem. But like I said, this is controversial. The Work and Pension Secretary took a different view of the situation. The problem, as he saw it, was that there is a group of people out there who think they're too good for this kind of stuff. Well, let's consider what the court said about it. There were three grounds of challenge. I'm only going to talk about two today. The first ground of challenge was based on a section of the Job Seekers Act. And the Job Seekers Act specified the kind of schemes that regulations could require of job seekers. And crucially, they stated that people could be required to participate in a scheme of any prescribed description. But the regulations didn't in any real sense describe the scheme. All you got was this: the Employment Skills and Enterprise Scheme, that was this kind of umbrella scheme, means a scheme within Section A known by that name and provided pursuant to the arrangements made by the Secretary of State. It would be like if you were trying to describe an elephant to a blind person, and you said, "An elephant is an animal known by that name and found in parts of Africa and India." And was that sufficient to meet any prescribed description? Well, Mr. Justice Foskett in the High Court found that this was adequate, albeit only just adequate, but the Court of Appeal disagreed, as in time did the Supreme Court. We'll get to the Supreme Court later. Let's consider now the second ground of challenge. She also won on this ground. It specified one of the requirements that had to be abided by in requiring her to take part in a scheme, and that was that she had to have notice in writing. But she was merely asked orally by her Jobs Centre advisor to participate. So clearly that was a breach of one of the conditions attached to the exercise of the power. Now, here is Sir Stanley Burnton. He was the Court of Appeal judge who gave the decision. And after concluding more or less as I have indicated on the prescribed description issue and on the requirement in writing, he said this: there's a constitutional issue involved. The loss of a job seeker's allowance may result in considerable personal hardship, and it's not surprising that Parliament should have been careful in making provision for the circumstances in which the sanction may be imposed, the sanction meaning the loss of job seeker's allowance for not taking part in the scheme. Notice, and this is really important as we go on, notice how Parliament, in this scheme of things, note how Parliament protects the interests of citizens. It's by attaching conditions to the exercise of the power. It's by saying, well, you must describe the scheme in the regulations. It's by saying, well, we can tell you to go on whatever scheme we want, but we must give you notice in writing. That's the kind of way that, in Sir Stanley Burnton's view, and he's not wrong as a description of our constitution, that's the way we protect the interests of citizens. And sure enough, she won. So, you know, maybe one cheer for Lord Diplock. Maybe we have made great progress. But only one cheer, because there's a number of questions we can ask about that decision. How far did the grounds of action in Caitlin Riley's case align with the underlying grievance against the administration? The dispute, which comes out much more clearly in the media statements, is that Caitlin Riley thought that this scheme was doing nothing to make her more employable. It wasn't training her, and it was taking away all her time to volunteer and apply for jobs. Ian Duncan Smith, giving the opinion of Her Majesty's government, thought the problem was that it was a group of people who thought this kind of thing was too good for them. Was that even aired? And how much progress is this over the situation in 1968, the year of Lord Diplock's elevation to the House of Lords? And another question, which we'll get to in time, how did the law here serve as a source of administrative morality, or as the conscience of the administration? That's what we'd really want it to be doing, surely. Well, let's consider 1968. Here's what another distinguished constitutional lawyer, J.D.B. Mitchell, said in 1968. Even when allowance is made for the fact that the forms of action tend to emphasize procedure, it is clear that it is only in the rare cases that the authority has erred in substance or in principle. It has erred in procedure, and the procedural error is seized upon. The substantive grievance, which is felt by the individual, is the fact of a compulsory purchase or demolition order, and that is met with a sidewind. Though had the substantive grievance itself been at issue, the result might well have been different. Is that so different today? Is one of the questions we want to ask. But the next question is, what happened next? And that refers to the conscience of the administration point. The very day of the Court of Appeals judgment, the Secretary of State, reflecting on this rebuke from the court, made new regulations. And what did the new regulations did? They simply inserted descriptions of the scheme. Okay, but he didn't stop there. You've got to hand it for the work and pensions. You've got to hand it to the work and pensions secretary. You may not agree with his characterization of the problem, but once he'd reached that diagnosis, he was going to go ahead with the prescription. He introduced to Parliament on a fast-track basis legislation, the Job Seekers Back to Work Schemes Act 2013, that retroactively validated every sanction that had been given under the previous regulations. This then went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court found for Riley on the lack of notice in writing, but didn't find for her on the ground of the flaw in failing to describe the regulations. After all, the court had to give effect to the 2013 Act, which retroactively nullified her legal victory in the Court of Appeal. She then challenged this, and you know, we don't really need to get down to this, this isn't central. She then challenged this as a breach of her Article 6 European Convention rights to a fair hearing. And you know, she won on that point, although quite narrowly, on a quite narrow basis. So all in all, the question we want to ask is, what does this whole episode tell us, if anything, about the progress we've made towards a system of effective control of the administration by the courts? Firstly, what if any deeper public purpose did that litigation? Think of all the lawyers' fees and time and all the rest. What did we get for all of that? What was the deeper public purpose? The policy continued precisely as it did before, entirely unchanged. The only effect was to require Parliament to authorise the policy by statute, which it did, completing all its stages in something like 14 days. And with all due respect to the learned judge, Sir Stanley Burnton, Parliament didn't really think deeply about the protections in the scheme if the scheme failed to survive contact with the first person who, to give the most favourable interpretation to the Work and Pension Secretary, it didn't survive contact with the first person who thought this sort of thing was too good for her. We had to strip away all the remaining protections. So did the litigation resolve a grievance between the citizen and state in any kind of a way? Well, in some kind of completely formal sense, it did. The court gave judgment, dispute resolved, but this didn't get to the underlying dispute, which was about whether it was right to make Ms. Riley subordinate her career plans to the Department of Work and Pensions goals. The underlying grievance, to go back to 1968, we still have the same problem. The underlying grievance is still attacked by a side wind. And in what sense did the courts exercise judicial control over public administration? If the administrator simply procured changes to the rules to eliminate what were, I hope you'll admit, in the first place, quite minimal restrictions. Their decision did nothing to change practice. It did nothing to foster the best instincts of administrators in exercising their discretion under the law. No one went back to their desks and thought, wow, what do we need to do to achieve the goals of our scheme in a sense of justice towards the individuals affected by it? They simply eliminated the protections that supposedly Parliament had thought so hard about. So that's where we are. The next question is, how did we get here? If you go back to the 1968s, and I've quoted a lot, if we go back to Willie Robson and J.D.B. Mitchell, and really the great majority of their colleagues, you get a rather vibrant discussion. You get a rather vibrant debate with a lot of productive, creative ideas which, if developed properly and adequately, might have given us something really rather exciting in terms of an administrative law for this country. So they all agreed on certain things. They all agreed that public law as it existed then failed to give adequate redress to citizens who were wronged by administrators. And that the common law, as it then was, not only had failed to solve the problem, but was incapable of doing so. And they proposed various schemes to remedy that. Some wanted a Conseil d'État to be reconstituted within the Privy Council, a French-style administrative court made up of judges and administrators. Some wanted the creation of an administrative division of the High Court. Some wanted to build on the nascent tribunal system alongside a Scandinavian-style ombudsman. Some wanted a completely unlimited High Court jurisdiction to review the decisions of administrators. So at the level of institutional recipe, there was no agreement. But if you look behind that, you can see that they all agreed on the nature of the problem and the shape of the solution in abstract terms, in terms of both form and content. They agreed that what was needed was a system for redressing grievances between the citizenry and the administration. They agreed that what we needed was a kind of a common law of public bodies to nurture a commitment to legality in the administrative branch. And they all agreed on the shape of the solution. First of all, they agreed that any solution would have to give express consideration to whether a decision was right. The Wyatt Report, which we know from this being one of an influential report by the pressure group Justice, which led to the creation of the Ombudsman, in fact, it did much more than that. If you read it, the Wyatt Report said that their recommendations would, as they saw it, go far towards providing every citizen with a means of redress in the field of administrative law as complete and effective as it has for centuries enjoyed in the realm of common law. As complete as and effective as the citizen has enjoyed in the common law. Willie Robson thought that some form of appeal from this substance, note substance of a decision, is required in the more important cases. And if you don't like these LSE socialists, why don't you look to Oxford professor Harry Lawson, who thought that even with no limit to the jurisdiction of the court, if that were the case, they could judge matters as they did in criminal appeals. And don't worry about juridification or anything like that, to give a modern term. They would not be tempted to interfere a great deal and will look upon it as their business to check abuses, just as they did in the realm of criminal law. So the solution would have to give express consideration to whether a decision was right. Secondly, was this issue of balancing. It was the rule of law neither to protect individual rights against the encroachment of the state, nor to empower the executive to take any action necessary to the proper government of the United Kingdom, but to strike a balance between public and private interests. Here's Robson again. The aim of a sound body of administrative law should be neither to disappoint the reasonable expectations of the possessors of private rights, nor cripple the free activities of the individual, nor yet again to enable the executive tyranny to masquerade under a colourable imitation of judicial sanction. Asked before the Franks Committee whether such a scheme of unlimited jurisdiction would benefit the citizen or the state, Harry Lawson said, I think it would be in both the interests of the public and of the private person. So there's no conflict between public interest and protection of the private interests. Set up the right way, you can do both. For Mitchell, a reconciliation of these objectives, speed and efficiency of decision-making and justice to the individual is possible, but it is beyond the reach of the present system in this country, which frequently satisfies neither demand. And finally, and this is going to be important as we come on, is the issue of policy. What about, isn't the problem with all of this is that it allows judges to interfere, take policy decisions that are rightly those of Parliament and the administration? Well, the reformers of the 1960s would have agreed with that, but they had a much, much narrower conception of what was a policy decision. These days we equate policy with pretty much any aspect of the merits of an administrative decision. But for the reformers of the 60s, it meant something rather more specific than that. Mitchell again, the root of the whole present malaise is the fact that we have lost any real idea of what is a political decision. And by extending the concept unreasonably, we have brought a great deal of trouble on ourselves. Again, you can find, Rick Mitchell was one of the radicals, but you can find similar sentiments in other people's views. Before the Franks Committee, actually, someone asked Willie Robson, What really is your disagreement with Sir Carlton Allen, the arch-conservative? And he agreed that this was the real difference was really one of tone. In matters of substance, there wasn't that much separating them. So I want to emphasize the breadth of the coalition of agreement behind these points. Let's fast forward to the contemporary position. How different is it? How different is our present day administrative doctrine from what we had back then? We start here with a quotation from Tony Blair's Lord Chancellor, the last real Lord Chancellor, Lord Irvine. I start with a restatement of the principles. They are, firstly, that judicial review is not an appellate procedure. The court must not substitute its opinion for that of the decision maker. The court must rule upon the legality of a decision and not its correctness. The court will concern itself with the manner in which a decision is reached rather than with the substantive merits of the decision itself. Or Sir Harry Wolfe, as he then was in his Hamlin lectures, judicial review is primarily concerned with enforcing public duties on behalf of the public as a whole, and is only concerned with vindicating the interests of the individual as part of a process of ensuring that the public bodies do not act unlawfully and perform their public duties. So these are statements of modern shibboleths, which I'm intending to pronounce Sibboleth from now on, I think. Consider the difference and consider the move. Express consideration as to whether a decision was right became the court must rule on the legality, not on the correctness. Law should mediate between public and private interests becomes law should ensure that public bodies perform their public duties. Fostering the emergence of a spirit of justice, to use Robson's favorite phrase, in the exercise of administrative discretion becomes an expansive exclusion from consideration of the courts of policy matters, which notionally encompasses all aspects of the substantive merits of the decision. And ladies and gentlemen, I hope you'll indulge me if I give you a metaphor for how I see it. It's as if we were promised this, but what we got was this. you'd be pretty disappointed, wouldn't you? So the next question is, you know, well, why? So, and that's the story of the counter-revolution. And it starts with executive government itself. The Law Commission was initially supportive of law reform ideas put forward by the guys I've just discussed. And in its first work report, it talked of the need for a proper balance to be struck between the rule of law and the administrative techniques of a highly developed industrial strategy. It didn't propose to do anything right now because it considered the problem such a complex one that they wanted time to study the problem and reflect before acting. Possibly that was their mistake, because in the meantime there was mobilized resistance from the departments. Now, executive government acted in some ways quite cynically here. In some ways they even denied the problem. The files record the thoughts of one Treasury official in the 1920s who thought grievances against the administration to be a well-recognized form of hallucination attributable to a fairly well-recognized class of semi-lunatics. So you can add that to your accusations against Caitlin Riley if you choose. But that was exceptional. They took the problem seriously. They understood that there was a degree of dissatisfaction with the way administrative powers were being used against individual citizens, and they were mindful that something had to be done about this. But, in the words of Sir Edward Bridges, they feared that judicialization of administration would lead to administrative chaos. And they also felt that having judicial control or judicial control of administrative decisions would undermine Parliament's preeminent role in executive scrutiny. A permanent official in the Lord Chancellor's office put it thus: "Everyone knows what nervousness is engendered in ministers and officials alike by parliamentary questions, and how often administrative action and practice are modified as the result of parliamentary questions." And even Willie Robson would agree with that. "The most ancient function of Parliament," he wrote, "is the redress of grievances, and this remains one of its essential tasks. Mere existence of opportunities for a debate on expenditure and to ask questions," he said, "affords considerable protection against negligent, inefficient, arbitrary, extravagant, and oppressive administration." So the departments coordinated their response and they leaned on the Lord Chancellor's office. Sir George Coldstream, the permanent secretary of the Lord Chancellor's office, called Sir Leslie Scarman in for a chat. Scarman, later Lord Scarman, was chairman of the Law Commission. And they turned to the issue of a review of administrative law. "The Law Commission," Coldstream said, "couldn't possibly look at this matter. It's far too complex. It needs far too much, not just legal experience. The only way we could do this would be to have a Royal Commission. So maybe the Law Commission should let it lie." Coldstream noted that he seemed to have got through to Scarman, and perhaps he did, but not in the way he intended, because the very next Law Commission work report said that we need to have a Royal Commission or similarly bodied to look at administrative justice against the state. And that review never happened. And to understand why, I need to introduce you to this chap, Lord Scarman, Lord Diplock. Le Quesnay and Sedley, in their entry on Lord Diplock in the Dictionary of National Biography described Lord Diplock as having a smile that would do justice to any shark. You can assess for yourself whether you think that's really true. But Lord Diplock intervened at this point, and Lord Diplock sent a memo to the Lord Chancellor, Lord Gardiner. Here it is. You can read it in the National Archives if you choose. And what it said was this: don't have a review. Let the Law Commission look at procedure if they want. I mean, that's a useful task that they can undertake. Some of my judicial colleagues and I have met with our American brethren, and we discussed the issue, and we decided that we judges can handle the situation. Leave it to us. And he really praised the American way of doing things, with one exception, and the exception related to matters of policy. All courts, he said, disclaim any intention of interfering with administrative decisions on grounds of policy. But the temptation to do so is not easy to resist where the policy does not relate to complex technical matters, but involves social considerations where judges feel that they are as qualified to weigh as the administrative decision-making authority. So, he thought, public law should develop so as to enable the reviewing court to perform its function of having the final word on disputed questions of law in administrative decisions without tempting it to obtrude into questions of policy, which should be decided by those to whom Parliament or local electors have confined a policy-making discretion. And a couple of summers ago, Arvind and I spent some happy days, many happy days in fact, reading through every single one of Lord Diplock's administrative law judgments in the 1970s and early 80s, and boy are they heavy going. But at the end of it all, you get to a Diplockian turn in administrative law, and this is what the Diplockian turn amounts to. I mean, to summarize it first, what I'm going to argue is that every single one of Lord Diplock's decisions in the 1970s and 80s can be seen as substantiating this plan that he formulates set out in his memo. And if I may pause the serious part of this lecture now to have a rant, think about how we tell our undergraduates about how the common law gets made. We tell them something like this: a dispute arises on which the law is unclear or undecided or silent. It's litigated, the judge decides, lays down a rule. But, you know, the boundaries of the rule may be a bit unclear, they may be ambiguous, it might not be entirely apparent how it would apply to some slightly different circumstance. But these slightly different circumstances arise, and over time the rule gets clarified. And over time we get a fairly determinate common law that blunders into wisdom, to use that famous phrase. That's not what happened here. Lord Diplock, as seen in the memo, is the man with the plan, and this is the plan. There's three aspects to the Diplockian turn. Firstly, the establishment of a rigid distinction between questions of law, on which the courts have the final word, and questions of policy, on which the courts have no say. The focus is on determining the limits of discretion conferred upon the administrator, rather than the balance between departmental interests and private interests. Provided administrators directed their mind to the correct question, to use a phrase that comes up again and again and again, it can be found earlier in the writings of in the judgments of Lord Green, for whom Lord Diplock was judicial assistant in the 1940s. Provided administrators direct their mind to the right question defined by law, the courts do not scrutinize the answers. And finally, as indicated by the last point about having material to make the decision on, limiting the available material to the court, ideally to a statement of the grounds on which the decision was taken, from which the judgment can be made as to whether they asked the right question. And so here's how the Diplockian turn gets us from the ideals of the 1960s to the modern shibboleth. He turns us from, has the administrator made the right decision, to, has he asked the right question, directed his mind to the proper manner, to the court must not rule on the legality of the correctness. We get from law should mediate between public and private interest, from his statutory emphasis on the decision-making statutory context, the duties on the decision-maker are to be inferred from the statutory framework and context, quite narrowly defined, to law should ensure that public bodies perform their public duties. And finally, from fostering the emergence of a spirit of justice in the exercise of administrative discretion, we get via the idea that courts should not be able to call for the record but rely on limited materials, to the idea of an expansive policy exclusion notionally encompassing all aspects of the substantive merits of the decision. So Lord Diplock was crucial in this, not just in that he was giving a judgment in all the major cases in the 70s and 80s and often the lead judgment, but that his actual ideas were quite instrumental in getting us from the 60s to the modern shibboleths. And for the next part, I do want to speculate a bit as to why. Why would someone have done this? If this was a social science lecture, you'd be wanting to know now, are you going to get an agency answer or a structure answer? In fact, you're going to get both. Lord Diplock's decisions are the agency part of the answer, but we should also consider the why part. And I think there's two parts to the answer. First, the courts at this point placed their faith, as did other constitutional actors, in pluralism, which I'll define in a minute, as a way out of the constitutional crises of the early 20th century. We all learn about the constitutional crisis of 1909 to 1911, when the House of Lords was at loggerheads with the House of Commons over the budget, over the policies which the state would pursue. Similar conflicts could be expected to arise between the courts and the fact that the British population were steadily starting to vote for socialist governments. What should judges who by and large weren't socialists do in this situation? And second, we have to consider the overweening power of the executive in the British Constitution. And these two things working together, I think, explain why Diplock's strategy was a sensible one, whether or not it was the right one, how we can make sense of it. So let's consider the purpose of the state, not in political philosophy, but as expressed in legal doctrine. And I think a number of cases illustrate some views about the purpose of the state in doctrine. Let's start with Roberts and Hopwood, 1925. This is Poplar and Sir George Lansbury versus Herbert Morrison. This is back to what should a local authority be able to do to alleviate poverty? In Roberts and Hopwood, Poplar Council was empowered by local government acts dating back to the 19th century to pay in the words of the statutes, such wages as they think fit. Now, if you just looked at the words of the statute, you would think that was a pretty open-ended discretion. But the House of Lords thought not, and we teach today, partly because we think it's quite amusing, we teach today Lord Atkinson's dictum. The council would, in my view, before I read this, I should mention a couple of things. Two of the particular decisions they made were, firstly, that they would pay men and women the same amount. And they would pay more than the market rate for hiring labour to reflect the fact that there were price increases following the end of the First World War. And this was unlawful, notwithstanding the open-ended discretion. The council would, in my view, fail in their duty if, in administering funds which did not belong to their members alone, they put aside all these aids to the ascertainment of what was just and reasonable remuneration to give for the services rendered to them, and allowed themselves to be guided in preference by some eccentric principles of socialistic philanthropy, or by a feminist ambition to secure equality of the sexes in the matter of wages in the world of labour. And we laugh at this because, you know, it's so anachronistic. But I'm going to say, controversially enough, that in the world of 1925, in the administrative law as it was at this time, this was not a completely unreasonable decision. But what it was doing was expressing the idea that the law implicit in it contains substantive norms about what was and what was not a proper use of public funds, not derived from a particular statute directing what was the purpose of those funds voted by Parliament in that statute, but coming from the general principles of the common law itself. You see, a similar decision being made later. Prescott and Birmingham City Corporation, now we're in the 1950s, this was a local authority that decided to give free bus passes to pensioners. And we see the same decision as Roberts and Hopwood articulated without the sound bites, but in roughly the same manner. Notwithstanding the open-ended statute, the law has something to say about what is a proper use of public funds, and gifting one group of ratepayers at the expenses of another is not it. Fast forward another 30 years and we have Bromley and Greater London Council. This was the so-called Fares Fair case. This was about Ken Livingstone as leader of the Greater London Council subsidising the prices of bus tickets and tube tickets in order to get people off the roads essentially and into public transport. It is actually the subject of one of the few jokes in public law, and there are so very few jokes in public law that I hope you'll indulge me if I tell it. It's not really a joke, it's more of a funny story, but that's how much of a scraping of the bottom of the barrel it comes when it comes to gags in public law. Ken Livingstone's transport person was a guy called Jeff Banks. After the GLC lost in the Court of Appeal, Banks stormed out of the building on the Strand, marched up to a TV camera and a microphone and described the judges as vandals in ermine. Vandals in ermine having destroyed this progressive public transport. The News of the World newspaper misreported to this, saying Banks described the judges as vermin and sandals. Same thing. In one level, the same thing as Roberts and Prescott. A redistributive kind of transport policy challenged in the courts. The courts say this is unlawful. If you're John Griffith, you think this is much the same in doctrine as well. highly reminiscent of the language and approach of the law lords in the Poplar case nearly 60 years previously. Now, with respect to John Griffith, that's not quite right. A subtle change has taken place, and you can only see this by really reading the reasoning. As you see in Roberts and Hopwood, you see an explicit reference to ideology, and the ideology inherent in, as the judges see it, inherent in the common law. None of the judges in Bromley do that. What they do, you can see this especially in Lord Diplock's speech, they say effectively this: it's not for the judges to intrude in matters of ideology. It's not for the judges to decide what is good or bad use of public funds. In Diplock's speech, essentially, you get the idea this is to be determined from the statutory framework. The statutory framework that a couple of different acts set purposes and set a scheme of and objectives of obtaining value for money and economy and so on. And, you know, the effect's the same. We still find it unlawful. But it's not because of our ideology, it's because of the ideology expressed in the statute. So that's what I mean by pluralism. Pluralism, for the political philosophers, is a political system highly inclusive and extensively open to public contestation. It's democracy that's not yet perfected. Different groups jostling for power, reaching sometimes temporary unstable alliances which come together and break up. Politics, in short, is a dirty business, and it's not the job of the courts to get involved in this business. All the courts have to do is to give effect to the decisions of this process of contestation. In Dowell's influential article on the US Supreme Court, he says, and this is, at the time, quite a controversial view of the US Supreme Court: it exists not as a counter-majoritarian force, but part of the dominant national alliance, giving effect to, when the Supreme Court sets its face against the will of the majority, it's because the will of the majority is dissolving or is not, you know, not stable. Pluralism UK style, as articulated implicitly in the decisions of the courts here in the 70s and 80s, is it was the role of judges to give effect to decisions reached through the political process. That's why judges must disclaim any interference with the administrative decisions on policy grounds, because to do so would be to set their face against the will of these temporarily assembled majorities. And secondly, we have the idea of overweening executive power. We tell our first year public law students about Lord Hailsham and elective dictatorship, and we quote this phrase at them: until recently, the powers of government within Parliament were largely controlled either by the opposition or by its own backbenchers. It is now largely in the hands of the government machine, so that the government controls Parliament and not Parliament the government. And I'm not quite sure what Hailsham means by "until recently," but you certainly find the exact same thought in Sidney Low, The Governance of England, in 1904, that the House of Commons no longer controls the executive. On the contrary, the executive controls the House of Commons. And I want to, that's a snap from the Sturton family album. In the middle is not a family member, I hasten to add. That's Jeremy Bentham. Now, some of you might know of Bentham's constitutional code. This is his scheme for enlightened nations who can adopt the scientific principle of utility as the basis for their government. But slightly less well known is another work, Securities Against Misrule. This is his scheme for less enlightened nations. Something I think quite instructive that about Bentham that you might want to know. It was Christopher Hood that told me this. Bentham wrote a lot of his work in French. And the reason he wrote it in French was he felt that if you wrote in a language you were comfortable with, you'd only mislead yourself with your pretty rhetoric. So best to write in a language you weren't very good at. I think the results are somewhat obvious. Here's the idea of securities against misrule. He proposed this for the Sultan of Tripoli. The here proposed system of arrangements, he says, has for its object, as the title imports, the applying to such of the evils as are most apt to be produced in the immediate agency of the monarch or those in authority under him, such remedies as present the least unpromising chance of obtaining the application of them at his hands. Whatsoever may be the chance which the here proposed remedy affords of being productive of the desired effects, the smallness of it affords not any ground of objection to it. For under a monarchy, such being the nature of the case as not to admit of any other, the option is this or none. And the case in which security against misrule is most needed is that in which the laws being altogether at the command of the rulers, the very work of their hands, no violation of law can be needed for the accomplishment of the misrule. Phew. Here's what he's saying, I think, in modern language. When dealing with an executive power with untrammeled authority, the only effective limits on its power are those to which the executive itself consents. And that being the case, the fact that we get in the protections, the securities against misrule, hardly any protection at all, that's not a feature, that's a bug. Because if you gave any stronger protection, you'd never persuade the executive to go along with them. And the sort of restraints likely to be acceptable are neither substantive nor procedural. They are based on formal conditions attached to the exercise of power. Bentham gives the example of a protection against arrest. So one way you could protect against arrest is to give citizens a right against arrest, in a wrongful arrest or something like that. Bentham, as you can imagine, had nothing to do with that. What he imagined, well, let's say you give a power of arrest, you also specify the rank of the arresting order officer, the list of offences for which arrest can be given, and so on, and through requirement of conformity to these formal conditions, you get some kind of protection against misrule. And 200 years apart, I think that's roughly what Diplock was working on. I'm not going to suggest that Diplock was reading Bentham and thought, ha-ha, that's a great idea. Diplock wasn't that sort of person. A story about Lord Diplock is this. One of his judicial brethren complained to him that the House of Lords law library was in fact no good at all. Diplock was entirely unsympathetic. Why do you need a law library, he thought. All you need is your own intelligence and a set of appeal cases. But Bentham has had a huge influence on the common law overall. And here's why I think there are some historical parallels. Both Bentham of Securities and Diplock seem to be dealing with different setups, monarchy versus polyarchy. But both are situations of power without external enforceable limits. And in their own way and in their own language, each settled on a scheme of legal protection based around formal conditions associated with the exercise of power, with weak incidental protection of the individual interests. Think back to Caitlin Riley. The protection of her interests came in the form of you have to be told in writing. The scheme has to be described in regulations, not just named. But, you know, there was no substantive, no even procedural, unless you consider a requirement in writing, a procedural limitation. There was a formal limit on attached with the exercise of power. So that's how we got here. In the last few minutes, I want to consider what is to be done and the shape of a solution to the current mess, if I can call it that. So let's not be naive about it. The conditions in which the current system emerged, polyarchy, overweening executive, they're still with us. We can't just ignore them, pretend they don't exist, and shape a solution that ignores that. But maybe what we should do is give up on the idea that judicial review is a means of controlling executive power. It wasn't in Willie Robson's day, and Caitlin Riley would probably tell you it isn't in our day either. So what use is administrative law then? Well, an alternative vision might be to think of administrative law, to focus on the resolution of grievance as the primary object of administrative law, whatever its effect in controlling power. Give up on that and focus on the remedial aspect of it. That's what other administrative justice bodies do. Like, that's largely what the Ombudsman does, for example. What would such a scheme look like? It would be focused on administrative wrongs. It would be concerned of setting standards of good conduct. And it would enjoin administrators from harming private interests. It would move from a protection of the public interest to prevention of harming private interests when they fail to meet those standards. And if you accept that as a new starting point, here's how Riley might have been decided. What were the administrative wrongs here? The first question, did the Department of Work and Pensions harm Ms. Riley in their attempt, did they harm her attempt to pursue her chosen career goals? To what end, what is a suitable remedy? Because being a bit more charitable now in the final few minutes to the Department of Work and Pensions, the dispute is really about this. We have an activationist scheme of welfare policy. That has been decided. That's our law. That's decided by Parliament enacting the Job Seekers Act. That's not up for dispute in the courts, nor should it be. But here we have, on the one hand, Ms. Riley saying, hold on, this is in no way helping me to be an active member of the labour market. And we have the Department of Work and Pensions saying, essentially, we don't care. We want you to take part in this scheme, no matter what the consequences are. What would William Robson have thought about this? What he would have thought about it would, I think, have been something like this. These are, in some sense, both reasonable positions. There are limits to which the state should indulge individuals' wishes to pursue whatever their careers are to unlimited extent. But also there are limits to the extent to which the individual should be made to suffer for a policy goal. Have we reached the goal? What I think Willie Robson and people of his era would have said, well, Caitlin Riley should be afforded the opportunity to argue that what she's doing now is a better way of achieving the goals of the policy than going on some stupid stacking shelf scheme. And for that to be heard before someone, it could be at an administrator, it could be a judge, it could be someone else, but who would make that decision as to pursue the objects of the policy in a spirit of justice. And that is something that she never had the opportunity to do. So, to the extent that that gives up on some of the more ambitious goals of administrative law, I think we have to admit that Bentham was right on this way. The meanness of the remedy is no objection to it, as long as we have an overweening executive. But there's still an opportunity for an effective system of citizen redress, even in the absence of a system of control over public administration.
So, Professor Arvind, who's come all the way here from Newcastle today, is going to give the opening.
Right, I should start by saying that I am very pleased to be giving this leading this vote of thanks for Professor Stilton's inaugural lecture. When I told Lindsay I was going to be very pleased and delighted to give the vote of thanks, he turned pale. But I have promised that I will largely stick to the many aspects of his academic work which I've seen over the 17 years I've known him. For example, his unfailing ability to convince a funding body that they must fund a summer trip to Jamaica for him every summer. But let's think a bit about some of the ideas Lindsay's been talking about today. And I'd like to take the chance to make three or four observations about those and perhaps put them in the broader context of what I think Lindsay's broader academic project is. Firstly, Lindsay's work is characterized by a rootsless objectivity. Lindsay's work, as you've seen today, concedes nothing to settled understandings, no matter how long those understandings have been held, and he concedes nothing to accepted narratives and myths, no matter how comforting those myths and narratives are. It is comforting, it is truly comforting to believe that the 20th century saw the enduring problem of legal control of government finally resolved through the creation of judicial review. It is comforting to believe that judicial review represents the coming to fruition of long-established constitutional principles. Yet, as Lindsay has shown us today, it is at least questionable whether the hard facts of the history of judicial review and the current doctrines of judicial review, when seen in the light of this history, actually bear out any of these beliefs that we hold to be self-evident. Underlying Lindsay's objectivity, his rootsless objectivity, as I've called it, is also a commitment to precision. This commitment to precision leads Lindsay to set aside the broad conceptual categories that are so beloved of legal theory in favor of a much more empirically guided approach where the ideas and categories spring from direct engagement with the evidence, doctrinal evidence, historical evidence, quantitative evidence. If one approaches that evidence without the preconceptions that the created layers of theory leave us with. We've seen that in action again today. But the deeply unsettling, to me at least, conclusion at the end of Lindsay's talk that in the course of the 20th century, the common law of judicial review has blundered not into wisdom, but into an 18th century folly. A legal equivalent, if you like, of Brighton Pavilion, ornate, compelling, beautifully sculpted, but at the end of no practical use whatsoever. Part of Lindsay's ability to do this comes, I think, from the interdisciplinarity, which was hinted at in the introduction. We talk about interdisciplinarity, but it's quite a rare scholar who is as comfortable discussing how one might design a Hayekian welfare state, which I wouldn't have believed existed until I read Lindsay writing about it, as he is talking about the intricate details of the case law on judicial review. And it's also rare to find a scholar who is as comfortable discussing the mathematics of Bayesian item response theory as he is discussing Hegel's theory of the bureaucracy. If I have to find one word to describe Lindsay, I call him a glass breaker. I'm not referring now to his misadventures with wine glasses, although there's a lot that could be said about that. But what I have in mind is a phrase from Paul's epistle to the Corinthians, where he talks about how we sometimes see through a glass darkly. Paul's use of the phrase comes from rabbinic Judaism, and in particular from the Talmud, where there are references to how most of us see through a dim lens, but a few can see brightly. And I think what Lindsay is trying to do in his work is take on what one might call the classic realist project of looking beyond the clouded lenses that darkly obscure a vision of the law, not due to legal doctrine as is commonly held, but due to the narratives and theories that we construct around doctrine. In various ways, in a variety of areas, Lindsay's work has shown the importance to the goals of academic legal scholarship of being able and willing to shatter the lenses that we live with, but which all too frequently cloud the legal vision and trammel the legal imagination. This has particular resonance in public law. Unlike contract, unlike tort, public law hasn't had a Patrick Attia. It hasn't had a John Fleming. It hasn't had someone who comes and tells us these beliefs you hold about doctrine do not square with the reality of what the law actually does in the everyday world. And I think in Lindsay's lecture today, we've seen the start of perhaps a way to getting there in public law, a situation to getting to the place that the common law of tort, the common law of contract have already reached. And I'm sure I speak for more than just myself when I say that I look forward very much to seeing where Lindsay goes with the ideas he's been discussing today. So, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of all of us in attendance tonight, I would like to thank Professor Sturton for his lecture and for the insights it's brought us.